and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for March 20th, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, how the sun's corona is so much hotter than its surface, the power of neighborly advice in predicting how you'll feel, and treating neuropsychiatric disorders with electrodes in the brain. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society at www.aaas.org.
During a total solar eclipse, the only part of the sun you see is the corona, which extends more than a million kilometers from the surface of the sun. It's very hot, about a million degrees or more, but the surface of the sun is only about 5,000 degrees. So how is it that the corona is so much hotter than the surface? Astronomers and astrophysicists have been puzzling over that one for some time. But now, in a paper in this week's Science, David Jess and colleagues may have the answer. They've measured incompressible magnetohydrodynamic waves called alphane waves in the lower solar atmosphere that are energetic enough to heat the solar corona. I spoke with Jess from his office in Queen's University in Belfast.
The important thing is, I mean, everyone here on Earth is interested in free energy. And one of the points is that here on Earth, we've been putting a lot of work into nuclear fusion, but unfortunately, there's a lot of problems trying to sustain this here on Earth. However, the sun, of course, is a nuclear fusion source that has been doing this for 24/7 for millions of years. And one of the reasons the sun can maintain this, obviously, is because it has an efficient mechanism to transport its energy throughout the whole of its atmosphere. And it was proposed that alphane waves might be able to transport this energy, but of course they were never detected on the sun in the past. And it's only really until this discovery, in our paper at the minute, that shows that these waves do exist. And of course this may open the door for helping people here on Earth try and promote and sustain nuclear fusion reactions here on Earth, and of course ultimately perhaps providing free energy.
Now, I know alphane waves have been measured in the corona itself before and also have been shown to be strong enough to power the solar wind, but those waves weren't found to be energetic enough to heat the corona, but you and your team detected them and they've got the energy to both reach and, you report, heat the corona. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, of course, the study that we have is the field of view is relatively small compared to the overall size of the sun, but of course, from the particular point that we analyze and examine, that this particular point is definitely energetic enough. And of course, if these bright points, which we know they are readily abundant, if they all contain a similar mechanism, then the overall heating of the corona is definitely possible with these waves. I mean, previous studies that have examined the entire surface of the sun do find that similar bright points to the ones that we find in and analyze in our paper are readily abundant on the surface of the sun.
How big is this bright point group?
The actual structure that we detect these waves in is probably, you know, since I'm from the UK, I mean, this is the actual bright point group is at least twice the size of the UK in terms of surface area. So these are definitely not small structures on the sun, but, you know, because of their this massive size, they can carry a huge amount of energy.
And what kind of resolution did you and your team get in looking at this bright spot?
Resolution-wise, we were getting down to around 80 kilometers resolution. So we had 40 kilometers on each pixel of our CCD camera, which is really unprecedented resolution. These are some of the sharpest images of the sun recorded to date.
And how did you and your team measure these alphane waves, the bright spot, and then look at the velocity shifts needed?
Of course. I mean, an alphane wave is essentially a wave that propagates from point A to point B, but only in a circular direction about the direction it's traveling. I think probably the best way to realize this is if you think of it as an elastic tube stretched between two points, which then at one point you twist it in a circular motion, and that causes the wave to move from point A to point B. Of course, then the twisting of this will, of course, induce velocities. And by getting down to this resolution that we've been able to achieve with the Swedish Solar Telescope, it is these twisting velocities that we were able to determine through the Doppler motions that the plasma makes when they're undergoing a torsional twist.
Now, I had understood that the speed of propagation of the alphane waves depends on the strength of the magnetic field strength. Have you been able to get more information about either the speed or the magnetic field strength in this way?
Of course, yes. I mean, the two most important things for the speed of propagation of these alpha-in waves is the magnetic field strength and the density of the plasma. And of course, because this is right on the surface of the sun, the magnetic field strength is going to be incredibly high. And we do get very, very large velocities here, you know, well in excess of 20 kilometers per second. So these velocities of the waves are incredibly fast.
So would you say then overall the mystery is solved for why the corona is so much hotter than the surface of the sun?
I think we have definitely provided key insights into this problem. I think the next logical step is to be able to determine the energy that these bright points carry as a statistical study across the whole of the surface of the sun. Only this way could we conclusively state that these bright points are energetic enough to solve the mystery of coronal heating. But definitely, in terms of the short term, the bright point that we have in our field of view and where we detect these alpha-in waves definitely suggests that this could be the answer to the problem.
David Jess, thank you very much.
No problem whatsoever.
David Jess of Queen's University is lead author of a paper on the detection of alpha-in waves energetic enough to heat the solar corona. Legislation currently before Congress could affect the biomedical research and development community. Here with more about it is Science Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny.
House Energy and Commerce Committee Chairman Henry Waxman has introduced a bill that would allow the Food and Drug Administration to regulate generic versions of biologic drugs. Manufacture of biologics involves living cells, and analysis of whether new generics are comparable to previously approved drugs has been complex. Though Waxman has tried to pass similar legislation twice before, this is his first time doing so as committee chairman, which will give him more authority, and the first time it has appeared under the Obama administration. Members of the Senate are planning a companion bill. The legislation is opposed by the Biotechnology Industry Organization, which has stated its concern that even minor differences in the purity of a biotech drug can change its efficacy and safety. Energy and Commerce members Joe Barton and Anna Eshoo are also planning to reintroduce a generic biologic proposal. It would allow brand-name biotech companies a longer period of exclusivity on their products than the Waxman bill. Meanwhile, Congressmen Adolphus Towns, David Reichert, Jim Langevin, and Roscoe Bartlett have reintroduced the Great Ape Protection Act, which is designed to prohibit invasive research on great apes. Critics say the bill would halt virtually all U.S. chimpanzee research and have negative implications for disease research. A bill to create a national neurotechnology initiative has also returned in both the Senate and the House. One of its main goals is to establish a government office that would coordinate federal R&D related to understanding how the brain works and developing new treatments for disorders of the brain and nervous system.
That was Deputy Editor Barbara Jasny with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Online dating is a huge business, and every day, millions of people go online to look at the pictures and profiles of others and try to imagine what it would be like to date a person. Suppose for a minute that rather than getting to see a picture or read the posted details about a potential date, you instead got nothing but a peer evaluation of the last person who dated your potential date. Which do you think would be a better predictor of how you would enjoy the date? The picture and profile, or a peer's evaluation and nothing else? That's the question Dan Gilbert and colleagues posed to participants in the study, and the results, published in a paper in this week's Science, were surprising. Here's Dan Gilbert from Harvard University.
You know, when you close your eyes and imagine the future, you think you can do a pretty good job of it, not only imagining what's going to happen, but imagining how much you're going to like it. What we found, surprisingly, is that one of the best ways to predict how much you're going to like a future event is simply to find somebody who's already experienced it. In fact, knowing nothing whatsoever about the event and knowing only how another randomly selected individual in your own social network reacted to it will probably increase your accuracy dramatically over imagining the event for yourself.
How is it that people mispredict how they'll feel, their affective reaction, you call it in your paper, in any case?
Well, we do it all the time. Unless you've always ordered exactly the right meal, married exactly the right person, picked out exactly the right shirt, joined exactly the right profession, then you too probably misestimated how you would feel in the future. These errors, affective forecasting errors, they're called in psychology, are quite common, very well studied both in the laboratory and the field, And the real question isn't whether they exist, because they do. People dramatically overestimate their affective reaction to almost any kind of event in the future, but why they happen.
So in your team's study then, what were you trying to quantify?
We were trying to find out whether somebody's ability to predict their own affective reaction could be enhanced by depriving them of all knowledge of the situation about which they were making a prediction and giving them only information about how another person felt when they experienced it.
So what did you and your team do in testing this? What did the participants in the study do then?
Well, there were two experiments described in our paper. The first was an experiment on speed dating. This is a very common situation in which you're trying to predict how much you're going to enjoy something in the future, namely a few minutes spent with another individual. Women came to our laboratory and tried to predict how much they would enjoy having a speed date with a particular man. And we gave them one of two kinds of information. Either we allowed them to peruse the man's profile and see his photograph and learn about him, and then predict for themselves how much they were going to enjoy spending 5 minutes conversing with him. Or we gave them none of this information. They knew nothing whatsoever about the guy except how much the woman who had just spoken with him enjoyed her speed date. What we found remarkably was that people were dramatically more accurate in predicting how much they would enjoy a speed date when they simply knew how much someone else had enjoyed it, some total stranger whom they'd never met. Much more accurate, but to their own surprise as well, because when they were asked which information they would prefer to have and which kind of information they thought would make them the most accurate, they, by a landslide, said they would prefer to see the man's picture and read his profile. After all, that's the best way to guess what they'll like in the future. But they were wrong.
Now, how generalizable, though, is the surrogate strategy to other situations, a meal or other things? I mean, I would imagine that other cultures, people in other cultures might react differently, say.
Well, here's what we know for sure. As a matter of principle, this strategy, which we call surrogation, will be very effective when the variability among people's hedonic or affective reactions is low. So when it's true that most people like the same thing, then other people's reports of their experiences will be very, very valuable. So the question arises, how common is that? And of course, no one knows the answer. Nobody has done the research to survey every domain of human experience to find out just how variable or how common, how consensual our affective reactions are. But we would only point out that in our paper, we studied two very common situations, one in which people had to guess how they would feel if they got some negative feedback about their personalities, and one in which they had to guess how they would feel having a 5-minute interaction with another person of the opposite gender. So these were not exotic situations by any means, and in both of these situations, surrogation proved dramatically better than using one's own imagination.
So the surrogation strategy applies in the situation, not necessarily to the particular person. Say, if you invited a whole bunch of people, say, from Sri Lanka and asked them whether or not they'd enjoy dating this or that person.
Well, you can imagine that if you were to use as your surrogate a person from another culture or of another gender in a different age group, their experience is likely to become a less good predictor of your own. That's obviously true. The question is, would it still be better than your own imagination? That's what we're going to wait for future research to tell us.
Compared to this study, how have others attempted to improve the accuracy of this affective reaction forecasting?
Well, you know, trying to decide what you're going to enjoy the most in the future, what you'll like, what you'll hate, how much you'll enjoy it and how much you won't, is a task that most of us do every day, and we do it by closing our eyes and imagining. And many studies have tried to improve imagination because we know errors in affective forecasting are due, by and large, to errors of imagination. We imagine the wrong things. We leave out particular kinds of details. We put in certain details that won't actually come to be. This is very well studied, and previous attempts to improve the accuracy of affective forecasting have tried to improve the accuracy of imagination. By and large, those attempts have failed. People just don't seem to get better at imagining the future. So we took an end run around the problem. Rather than trying to make people better at imagining, we asked, might we stop them from imagining entirely? Might we prevent them from imagining a future situation and rely only on one real piece of data, namely how another person who already experienced that situation liked it? And what we found, much to our astonishment and to the astonishment of the participants, was that this dramatically increased the accuracy a participant's affective forecasts.
And you said that people don't really believe that a friend's evaluation is a better predictor. Is that right?
That is right. And it's not only that. In our studies, these weren't friends. These were random strangers who just happened to be attending the same university you did. Now, most of us, when offered that kind of information, would shrug and say, you know, I'm a unique individual. Nobody's exactly like me. How much someone else enjoys a speed date or a meal or a hobby or a movie, that might be a little bit of information about how much I would enjoy it, but not very much, because after all, I'm remarkably different from everyone else. Well, that turns out to be wrong. In terms of people's affective reactions, people are remarkably similar. You know, if an alien knew all of the likes and dislikes of a single human being, that alien would know a lot about our species, because people actually tend to like and dislike the same things. As a result, another person's report of their affective experience turns out to be a very good guide to your own. If most people like it, odds are very good you will too.
Dan Gilbert, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Dan Gilbert is lead author of a paper on the surprising power of neighborly advice. Also in this week's Science, the T-Rex of the Cambrian. Allison Daly and colleagues describe in a paper what's been nicknamed the T-Rex of the Cambrian period because of its large size and toothy mouth. About 540 to 500 million years ago, an arthropod called Herdia and its cousins dominated the sea. Sporting stalked eyes, gills in association with lateral flaps, frontal appendages, and a circular-toothed mouth structure. The research provides insights into the origins of important arthropod features, and fossils of the Herdia have been found in the Canadian Rockies, Utah, Bohemia, and possibly Nevada and China, suggesting that Herdia was a generalist adapted to a range of environmental conditions. Deep brain stimulation involves surgically inserting electrodes into the brain. It's helped more than 55,000 people suffering from Parkinson's disease, essential tremor, or dystonia regain control of their bodies and their lives. Over the past few years, researchers have been trying deep brain stimulation on neuropsychiatric patients suffering from major depression or chronic severe obsessive-compulsive disorder. As Science News writer Greg Miller reports, deep brain stimulation helps them too, but no one is quite sure how the therapy works. Here's Greg Miller.
This is a surgery where electrodes, metal wire electrodes, are implanted deep inside a patient's brain to provide current to neurons with the idea that a faulty neural circuit can be sort of shocked back into functioning properly. But we really know very little about how it works, and there are two papers in this week's Science that shed a little bit of light on it and at the same time kind of underscore how little we really know about how this works.
Who in particular, what diseases, what disorders, who's benefiting from deep brain stimulation?
So the most experience we have with this is for treating Parkinson's disease and a couple other movement disorders. And there are about 50,000 people or more who've had the electrodes implanted for those disorders. And it's helped them stop some of the tremor, for example, in Parkinson's, and help people initiate movements and just generally move more freely than they've been able to on drugs and other kinds of therapy. And it's also being tried now for depression and obsessive compulsive disorder and a whole range of disorders.
The idea being in the psychological disorders also to right the wrong firing of neurons?
Yeah, that's kind of the idea. So in Parkinson's disease, there's a circuit that's relatively well understood in the brain that's responsible for coordinating and controlling our movements. And the thinking in depression, for example, would be that there's an analogous circuit of brain regions that's responsible for controlling our moods. And if that circuit gets out of whack for some reason that we probably don't really understand very well, it might be possible with implanting these electrodes to compensate for whatever the defect is.
Okay, so that's how it helps or might potentially help. How more precisely does it work? You said people don't really know much. What do they know?
Right. So they know that these electrodes create an electric field near the tip that alters the electrical activity of nearby neurons. But exactly what they're doing is really not understood. And there are competing hypotheses that are seemingly opposed. So some people have argued that the net effect is to inhibit neural activity near the contact points of the electrode, and other people have argued that it's really stimulating neural activity near the electrode. And so at the mechanistic level, at the cell level, it's really not clear exactly what's going on.
How is it then that people came up with this idea of putting electrodes into the brain in the first place?
So there's a long history in the 20th century of doing surgeries to destroy little bits of brain tissue. People had known from animal studies and then from some studies initially with patients with really severe disorders that if you destroy a certain part of the brain, the patient often shows signs of improvement. You can alleviate some of the symptoms. But that's pretty extreme. Once you destroy a part of the brain, it's gone. And people had had the idea that by implanting the electrodes, you could disrupt neural activity in those brain regions that had previously been destroyed without actually destroying them. So it's a little bit less invasive and a little bit less permanent than actually destroying the brain tissue.
And it sounds like a little less risky. But what are the risks besides those from the surgery needed to implant the electrodes?
Right. So any kind of surgery, and of course brain surgery carries risks of infection and bleeding and that sort of thing. And there have been side effects reported in many patients with Parkinson's disease. They've reported some mood fluctuations and cognitive problems. There's one case report recently of an artist, a woman who was an artist, who felt that her creativity was diminished when her stimulators were turned on. And so there's some things like this, and it doesn't work for everyone. There's some patients who don't seem to respond to it.
Is it still sort of being seen then as a surgery of last resort, or is this along a course in which there's another option that would be further down the road of riskiness?
No, I think this is pretty much the last stop. I mean, this is really only for patients who've already tried several different drugs, and in the case of psychiatric disorders, have tried behavioral therapy and even electroconvulsive shock therapy, have really tried everything before going under the knife and getting these implants.
And just so we're clear, the deep brain stimulation form of therapy is approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration? Is that right?
It is for Parkinson's and for two other movement disorders. And recently, just last month, it was given approval for people with really severe obsessive compulsive disorder. But all of the other disorders are still being tried in pilot studies on an experimental basis.
Now, you said there are two papers in this week's Science on deep brain stimulation. What are they about?
That's right. So one paper uses some very exciting emerging techniques in neuroscience called optogenetics. And that's a combination of tools from genetic engineering and optics. And what those researchers have done is they've used genetic engineering to insert light-sensitive ion channels and pumps into neurons. And these channels were originally found in unicellular organisms, but through genetic engineering, you can stick them in neurons. And what that then allows you to do is control the activity of those neurons with pulses of laser light. And it's really cool for two reasons. One, you can have incredible temporal precision. So as soon as you flash the light, the channels and the neurons respond almost instantaneously. And the other really cool thing is the genetic engineering allows you to stick those channels in one type of neuron at a time. So you can target them to only excitatory neurons or only inhibitory neurons and see what happens when you take those neurons out of the loop or when you stimulate those neurons. So it allows you to do a sort of virtual dissection of a neural circuit. And so those researchers have now applied this in mouse and rat models of Parkinson's disease to try to address some of the ideas that scientists have put forward about how deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's might work. And to make a long story short, I think what they propose is that it's not actually the effects of deep brain stimulation on the neurons right in this target region where the electrode is, but it's actually how it affects the axons, the long extensions of neurons that are bringing signals into this area from the motor cortex, which is a movement control region on the surface of the brain. They think that's the key to the mechanism of the therapeutic effect in Parkinson's disease.
So a potential tool for understanding how this works, but probably not, given the genetic manipulation, something that's ever going to be applied in people.
Well, certainly not anytime soon. It's really just for understanding the circuitry and what goes wrong.
And the other paper?
The other paper is very different. These researchers tried a different kind of stimulation where they applied electrodes to the spinal cord in rat and mouse models of Parkinson's, and they found that they could alleviate the rodent symptoms by stimulating the spinal cord. And that's exciting because stimulating the spinal cord, or the operation to implant those electrodes in the spinal cord, is a lot less invasive than actually sticking wires, you know, several centimeters down into the brain. And so it can be scaled up for humans if it works in humans, and if it doesn't cause bad side effects in humans, all of which remains to be seen, it could potentially be a much less invasive surgery and treatment for people with Parkinson's disease.
It sounds a bit like the bionic age is upon us here.
That's what one researcher told me. This really does seem to be growing, and interest in it seems to be growing in part because these patients, you know, that are getting the surgery have tried absolutely everything else. I mean, some of them have been living with a severe illness for 20 years, and they've tried drugs and they've tried therapy. They've tried, you know, everything under the sun, and nothing has worked. And now a lot of them seem to respond to this.
Greg Miller, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Science News writer Greg Miller reports on the expanding uses of deep brain stimulation to treat a variety of neuropsychiatric disorders. The two science papers Miller spoke about are first by Romulo Fuentes and colleagues, titled Spinal Cord Stimulation Restores Locomotion in Animal Models of Parkinson's Disease, which is in the magazine, and second by Viviana Gradinaru and colleagues, titled Optical Deconstruction of Parkinsonian Neural Circuitry, which you can find online at www.scienceexpress.org. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of the latest science news. Hi, David. What's new?
Hey, Rob. I've got three great stories for you. We're going to talk about how dolphins steer their sonar, how caterpillars visit the pharmacy, and finally, how the solar system prefers lefties.
Well, I see you've brought a couple of sound files with you. I'm presuming that's going with the dolphins. Let's start then with how dolphins steer their sonar. Is it with some muscle in their head or something?
Well, it's actually a little bit more complicated than that. But the question is, you know, when dolphins and other odontocetes, which are also known as toothed whales, and that includes dolphins and sperm whales and beluga whales, when they're navigating in these murky waters in the ocean, they have to find a way to get around and they can't rely on their eyes. So they use, like bats use at night, they use sonar. And for a long time, scientists thought that sonar was sort of like headlights. You know, you pointed your head in one direction and that was the only direction your sonar beam went. And, you know, the sonar is sort of these acoustic waves that bounce off objects and they bounce back to you. And it's sort of a way of telling, you know, what's around you, even if you can't see it with your eyes.
Right. And unlike bats, they don't have much of a neck, do they?
In fact, many dolphins can't actually even move their necks. So researchers have wondered, you know, is there a way for them to sort of steer their sonar beams without having to turn their heads? And they first saw evidence of this actually last year. Researchers noticed that a dolphin they were studying could actually tilt its sonar beam about 20 degrees off from center either way without moving its head.
Left or right, but not up and down necessarily?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. Left or right. And so the question is, well, how are they doing that? And so that's what this new study is all about.
Now, you said it was more complicated, so it's not a muscle that they're moving in their head to move it around.
Well, that was one idea. That there was this fatty organ called the melon that actually helped the dolphins sort of aim their sonar beam. But what it turns out to be is it actually has to do with multiple sonar clicks. So here's what a sonar click sounds like from a beluga whale. And what you don't hear there, Rob, is because that's actually played at normal speed, it's so fast that you can't hear this double click, this second click that happens right after the first click. And that second click is really important. So now here it is slowed down. And it's that second click that you're hearing there that's really important for this sonar beam steering.
I can barely hear it. It doesn't sound like it's very far away temporally.
Right.
From the first click.
And that's the key.
Here it is again.
Right. Right. And that's the key, Rob. It's this idea that the dolphins are sending out one click, and this second click that follows immediately after cancels out, the way it's timed, it actually cancels out some of the sound waves emitted by the first click, and it cancels that out in certain directions. So some directions are amplified more than others, giving the dolphin the ability to sort of steer their beam left or right versus just going straight ahead.
So how is it that they make these two clicks? Is it that they've got two different melons? I thought that was part of the forehead.
No. Actually, Robert, it turns out they have two different what are called phonic lips in their head. And each of these lips produces a different sonar click. And we didn't know before if they used one or both of these lips, but it looks like they're using both and they're working in concert to produce the sonar directionality.
Now, bats also do sonar. Are they also able to create two clicks?
Well, they don't have this dual sound generator. They only have one. So it seems unlikely that bats would be able to direct their sound in the same way. But then again, they can move their necks.
Okay, next up, caterpillars that go to the pharmacy. Obviously, this isn't a literal pharmacy. So what are the caterpillars doing?
Well, you're right. It's not a literal pharmacy. It's a sort of nature's pharmacy. These caterpillars, and the caterpillars they study here are called woolly bear caterpillars. And there's these really fuzzy caterpillars. You can see a cute picture of one on the site. They tend to get infected with a particular kind of fly larvae. And these are sort of maggots that are living within the caterpillar. So obviously an unpleasant situation. And what scientists have seen in the wild is that when these caterpillars are infected, they're more likely to eat plants such as the Arizona popcorn flower that are filled with toxic alkaloids. So it's kind of like these plants are poisonous to the caterpillars, but the caterpillars don't eat too much to kill themselves. But the researchers noticed when the caterpillars were infested and they ate these plants, their survival tended to increase. So they wondered, are these caterpillars somehow self-medicating? Do they know that they're sick? And do they know what medicine to take when they're infested with these maggots?
Let food be your medicine and medicine be your food.
Right.
So caterpillars that weren't infested with this fly larvae, did they also eat this Arizona popcorn flower plant?
Well, that's what researchers wanted to find out in the lab. Is there a difference between the infested and the uninfested caterpillars?
In terms of their behavior?
In terms of the behavior, in terms of what they eat. And so they took these caterpillars back to the lab and they provided them with sugar or these toxic alkaloids. And what they found was that the infested caterpillars ate about twice as much of the toxin as uninfested caterpillars did. And what's more, that the caterpillars that were infested that ate the toxin had about a 20% better survival rate. So this was really the concrete evidence the researchers were looking for to show these caterpillars really know what they're doing. They're looking for this medicine when they're infected, and the medicine actually helps.
This seems like a very sophisticated behavior for a tiny little caterpillar.
Well, that's why it's such a cool story. You know, we obviously, as humans, we go to the pharmacy when we're sick. And even chimpanzees that are plagued by worms are known to swallow rough, bristly leaves that helps them scrape the parasites from their guts. So we know that other primates besides us can also self-medicate. But to see this behavior, this really complicated behavior in such a quote-unquote primitive organism is really fascinating.
And I imagine this discovery will prompt others to be looking for this behavior in all sorts of creatures.
Yeah, I bet it will.
Okay, so finally, the solar system prefers lefties. Usually that's a reference to people. Is that what you're talking about?
Actually, no, we're talking about left-handed molecules. And it turns out amino acids, you know, sort of the building blocks that we use that are so important for life on Earth, come in two varieties. They come in what's called a left-handed and a right-handed variety. And if you're chemically oriented, what that means is if you sort of look at the hydrogen on these molecules and you sort of treat the hydrogen as the thumb, all the other atoms either go to the left or the right of that.
So a construction by the chemists, lefties or righties, for these molecules.
Exactly. But here's what's interesting. You would assume, well, there's half of one, half of the other, so we must be like a mix of both left-handed and these right-handed amino acids. But in fact, all life on Earth is built only from left-handed amino acids. And so the question is, why? Why did life on Earth decide to go with these lefty molecules versus with righty molecules?
How on Earth could you possibly answer that?
Well, the question comes from not on Earth. It comes from these meteorites, which are actually older than Earth. The study deals with six meteorites that were discovered in Antarctica and Australia, and they're older than 4.5 billion years old, which means they're older than Earth. So they've been around, you know, in our solar system from before when Earth was formed.
And there are amino acids on them?
Yeah, these guys are actually chock full of amino acids. And there's sort of been speculation that, you know, some of the building blocks of life may have come from space and maybe even have come from meteorites like these. So maybe by looking at the amino acids in these these meteorites, it could tell us something about how life began on Earth. And when the researchers were looking at these meteorites, what they noticed is, you know, they again expected to find this sort of 50-50 split between left-handed and right-handed amino acids. But they found in all of these meteorites, there was more left-handed amino acids than right-handed. And in fact, in one of the meteorites, there was 20% more left-handed than right-handed amino acids. So this preference for left-handedness didn't just start with organisms on Earth. It seems to have even predated Earth.
Now, were these meteorites ones that struck the Earth recently, or is it possible they had been contaminated by bacteria already on Earth and so already having the left-handed preference?
Well, it doesn't really matter when they came. This idea that bacteria may have contaminated these meteorites is a potentially a confounding factor. In fact, one expert who commented on the study said, you know, if these bacteria preferred to eat right-handed amino acids versus left-handed amino acids, then that would cause this skewed ratio, which would have nothing to do with what the solar system actually, you know, quote unquote, prefers.
So behind the chemistry then, what would account for the left versus right-handed preference?
Well, there's two possible theories. These meteorites tend to have ice on them. And if this ice melts, it turns into water, obviously. And there's been experiments to show that water somehow favors the propagation of left-handed amino acids. So that could cause the skewed ratio. There's also a theory that the ultraviolet radiation in space somehow skews the ratio.
So the answer to the question why the solar system prefers left or right is we don't know yet.
We don't know yet, but this study does shed light on the idea of why we as organisms on Earth may be built from left-handed amino acids.
Because of the difference in abundance from the materials.
Exactly, exactly. But here's what's really interesting. You know, say it had been the other way around. Say there had been more right-handed amino acids in these meteorites. Could we all have been built from right-handed amino acids?
Or could some of us be built, or some creatures be built from right hand and others from left hand?
Right. Or to take it even further, are there some parts of the universe where creatures are built from right-handed amino acids? And what happens when we meet? You know, actually in the lab, the researchers tried this. They put these right-handed and left-handed amino acids in a sort of an organic environment and tried to combine them. And usually they would sort of combine to form something that was more biologically relevant. But they found, as they say, when they try to combine these two things in the lab, it turned into what they called scrambled eggs, which means it just sort of made a big mush and these things didn't interact in any sort of biologically useful way. So
we're all left-handed amino acids, but some solar system out there could be filled with all right-handed amino acids.
Exactly. And who knows what will happen if we ever meet.
Well, thanks, Dave. What other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into the West Antarctic ice sheet and how rises in global temperature are posing a real threat to this ice sheet, and also how the language of music is universal. And on the policy blog, Science Insider, we're following a story this week about a virologist that may have become infected with the Ebola virus and how that person's being quarantined. And finally, a story about introducing lie detectors based on fMRI imaging into courtrooms. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the March 20th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.